You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Mayin Hussein. I'm the medical oncologist and hematologist for Florida Cancer Specialists. I'm the current president of the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology. I'm honored and privileged to be here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Waseem Makaila. He's one of the thought leaders in breast oncology in, I would say, the Southeast, if not all of the USA. It's a pleasure to have you here, Waseem. Thank you for joining me in this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hussein, for the invite. I'm honored to be here as well.
Thank you. So today we're going to talk about metastatic breast cancer, specifically ESR1 mutated metastatic breast cancer. But before we go there, you know, there's a lot of changes in the management of estrogen receptor positive, estrogen receptor positive metastatic breast cancer these days. Can you just give us an update of what like is changing in the landscape of treating those patients?
Sure. I mean, it's an exciting time in breast oncology now, and there has been a lot of new treatment options, new hopes for those patients. So when we look at the HR-positive breast cancer, the first-line treatment hasn't changed much. The standard remains an endocrine therapy in combination with CDK4/6 inhibitor. And, you know, this first-line gives us a great median PFS ranging from 25 to 29 months. So patients do very well. I mean, we have patients who stay on those treatments. And as I tell the patients, it's a median PFS. So you can go on either side of the curve. But we do have patients who remain on those treatments for way more than that. And they have an excellent quality of life. They're taking two pills. They're independent from the clinic. And they're functioning and living a normal life. Once they progress on the first line, it becomes a little challenging because the PFS drops significantly from 25 to 28 months to somewhere around 7-8 months. And then you have the options of additional endocrine therapies. You have combinations of endocrine therapy plus targeted therapies. About half the patients, you know, now with newer approvals, will harbor an actionable mutation, such as a PIK3CA or an AKT or a P10 mutation. And there are targeted treatments in combination with endocrine therapy that are used for those particular mutations, but still your PFS in that space is around seven to eight months. But then you also have ESR1 mutations, and those are acquired mutations that the patient can receive a specific SERD for which with an excellent quality of life and excellent tolerance. Beyond that, you may or may not have any additional endocrine therapies and you may need to move to chemotherapy or ADC. And this is where the field also got very exciting with the approval of multiple ADCs in HR positive, whether they have a HER2 low or HER2 negative. So it keeps getting better and better. Not to forget that patients who have a BRCA mutation, they may benefit from PARP inhibitors somewhere earlier in the course of their treatment.
Very good. Thank you very much. And that's, I think, the question now. So when would you do genomic testing in metastatic, HR-positive metastatic breast cancer?
I think it's recommended to send your genomic profiling, your NGS, at the time of diagnosis because of the also recent approval of the triplet, which is a PIK3CA inhibitor plus a CDK4/6 plus fulvestrant. And that triplet is approved in a particular patient population that is endocrine resistance with a PIK3CA mutation. So this is first line, and you know, the gene profiling is indicated upfront. So those patients can be on the triplet if they're deemed to be appropriate for this triplet. So at the time of diagnosis, I think it's appropriate to go ahead and send the NGS.
And you're talking about inavolisib, which is they just got approval recently, yes.
Correct.
So that's very important. How about
inavo, palbociclib, and fulvestrant? Yes.
So when patient progress on first-line therapy, patient HR positive, forget the PIK3CA mutation presence, What would you do? Would you repeat? Would you get another biopsy, or would you just do a liquid biopsy? Does it depend on how fast they progress? I mean, does that make a difference?
It depends. I think it's case by case, but I think at the time of progression, depending. So in HR positive, actually, there's a couple points I want to make. Number one, sometimes obtaining a tissue biopsy is challenging in those patients with bone-only disease, and sending a bone biopsy for NGS profiling is not the easiest thing to do. So that's one issue. Second is depends on the progression. I mean, if they're fast progressors and they were bone only and they develop a new liver metastasis, I don't think it's a bad idea to re-biopsy. I have a tendency to re-biopsy and repeat biomarker testing and NGS profiling because I think it helps, especially when tumors are changing and if anything in the tumor has changed and you need to change your approach. Having said that, not at every progression you need to repeat a tissue biopsy, and I think liquid biopsies are indicated. And the liquid biopsy is mainly, especially in those HR positive cancers, to look for any ESR1 mutation, because the ESR1 mutation is an acquired mutation, and this is one of the mechanisms of resistance to the standard traditional endocrine therapy with AIs. So normally, the patients after 1 to 2 years of therapy, they develop an ESR1 mutation, about 40% of patients, and this allows them to escape from the standard endocrine therapy as the receptor becomes ligand independent and the ER pathway becomes automatically activated.
Right. So if I had a patient, I did a biopsy at the first line, metastatic, and I did both tissue and liquid, and I don't have the ESR1. Do I still have to repeat a liquid biopsy or a biopsy in general at progression?
Well, I don't anticipate to see an ESR1 mutation initially. I mean, the prevalence of this mutation is very low at the time of diagnosis, especially those patients with de novo metastatic disease. It ranges from 1 to 5%. So definitely at the time of progression, you need to repeat a liquid biopsy to look for the ESR1 mutation because it is an acquired mutation. It's not a founder mutation. It gets acquired under the pressure of therapy.
Yeah, so it's very important to repeat and look for it. So even if it was negative at first line, that doesn't mean it's going to be a negative afterwards. This is an acquired mutation, and it's important to check. And is liquid biopsy sufficient, or do I have to get like a tissue biopsy?
No, liquid biopsy is the standard. Actually, the liquid biopsy is able to collect the shedding tumor DNA from different metastatic sites, and it's actually more accurate. I've had cases where they progress in the liver. I biopsy the liver, and I get a liquid biopsy, and you can pick up the ESR1 mutation in the blood, but you don't see it on the liver. So it doesn't have to be in every location, every metastatic focus. It's way more accurate to do it by liquid biopsy.
Because some sites may not have it, others may have it. So this way, you're looking at the general view. So I just want to emphasize.
Quick
So,
turnaround.
yeah, and actually, it's easier for the patient just to get a blood draw instead of like going through an invasive procedure.
Correct.
How about if you do like a liquid biopsy and you find ESR1 and PIK3CA mutations, which one would you treat?
I think it depends on the patient. I think this is case by case. Remember, PIK3CA mutations, there are combination treatments. So you could be using fulvestrant in combination with alpelisib or with capivasertib. ESR1 mutation, you would be using single agent elacestrant. So when we, and we're not supposed to be comparing trials, right? Cross comparison. But when you look at the data, actually, if you look at the, for example, the CAPItello-291, the median PFS is around 7.3 months. When you look at the EMERALD trial, the PFS is very similar. And actually, when you look at patients who were on CDK4/6 inhibitors more than 12 months, the PFS is in the 8-9 months range. So they are effective. Patients with liver metastases, for example, heavily pretreated, were included in the EMERALD trial. And still, we saw some robust data in those patients. This is to tell you that I think it's a case by case. If a patient is diabetic and you're concerned, or has underlying diarrhea, or has some skin issues, and you're concerned about using a combination treatment, you might want to go for a single agent SERD, like elacestrant, and you know those are excellent tolerance, very effective. Or if you have a patient where you know you prefer the combination, or you want a higher response rate, you might want to go for the combination. I think at the end of the day, the patients who are not progressing very rapidly, and those patients where you want to use every endocrine therapy possible, you're going to end up sequencing your treatments. It's one after the other. The question is, which one works better before the other one? I don't think we have the answer for this. I think the future would be in combining the SERD plus the targeted agent. And this data is actually being studied in clinical trials and should be out in the next couple of years and should become the standard.
Yeah, so that's I think lead me. So you feel like the standard of care will combine ESR1 directed targeted drug medications in a first line setting.
In the second line at progression. So currently, I mean, we do have many trials looking at a SERD in ESR1 mutated plus or even not in ESR1 mutated plus targeted agent, like a PIK3CA. So all these combinations are currently being studied.
Yeah. How about first line? Do you think it's going to move to first line?
Well, with CDK4/6, yes.
Yes, right. So that's where you are. Okay, so in combination. Yeah, I know, not as a single agent, but it's in combination.
Yes.
Yeah. So how when you order a liquid biopsy you look for all mutations possible, right? You don't just look specifically for ESR1, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the liquid biopsy is accurate. I mean, they pick up, you know, like the PIK3CA mutation, I always pick it up on the liquid biopsy. So, and again, in particularly in HR-positive breast cancers, when you have bone-only disease, it's hard to get tissue or get a biopsy. So liquid biopsy comes in handy. As you said, non-invasive, high turnaround time, and accurate. So, you know, that's my go-to in those patients.
How long does it take you? How long does it take for a liquid biopsy to come back in your experience?
About like 5 to 7 business days. So
within a week, you get
it's a quick, yes.
Yeah. Have you seen any barriers, like, you know, from getting that type of biopsy?
Not that I know of. I think it's easier than a tissue biopsy. I mean, you're sending the blood on the spot. For example, when you're ordering a tissue biopsy for NGS, you need to make sure the pathology department ships the tissue. You have the right, you need to make sure you have enough slides and enough tissue for the NGS testing. While in the liquid biopsy, you're just sending the specimen from the clinic on the spot.
Very good. So does the allele variant, does that help you? Like if you have the both mutations and deciding, I mean, you mentioned like case by case, but does that make a difference or help you in making the decision?
Not at all. Each mutation has different allele variant expectations. So ESR1 tend to run low. I think it's either you have it or you don't have it, and that's what dictates the treatment. So I honestly do not look at the allele variant and the percentages when I'm deciding on the treatment. I don't.
So would you test a liquid biopsy at each line? Like let's say you patient progresses, you do the liquid biopsy, you don't have ESR1. Do you try different type of therapy? Maybe they have PIK3CA, and then they progress again. Would you repeat a liquid biopsy trying to find?
I think so. I think you can repeat as long as you're looking for the target for a particular treatment. I mean, it doesn't make sense to repeat the liquid biopsy if you had decided to go to chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So I don't see the point in repeating it. But if the patient still is a candidate for more endocrine therapy and you're looking for additional endocrine therapies before you move to systemic therapy, then I think it's appropriate to repeat at second or third line, or actually at every line to look for the ESR1 mutation, because it opens the door for an additional treatment option that's well tolerated and effective.
Which lead me to another question. When would you use antibody drug conjugates in those patients? When do you think is the appropriate time to use them?
So when So if you look at the DESTINY-Breast06, because DESTINY-Breast06 looked at HR positive, HER2 low and HER2 ultra low, post-endocrine therapy in chemotherapy naive patients. So those are the question in that study was, is T-DXd better than chemotherapy in those patients? So should I be using T-DXd? And I think this is a great question, by the way. Should I be using T-DXd instead of chemotherapy in those patients? The answer was yes. The short answer was yes. T-DXd was superior to chemotherapy in those patients when it comes to response rate, to PFS, et cetera. But the main question and the main confusion I see when talking to the community physicians is they feel that you're trying to rush to ADC. You're not comparing ADC to endocrine therapy. Absolutely not the question. I use ADC when I make the decision that this patient is going to systemic therapy.
Chemotherapy, you mean? Yeah, right.
Yes.
Yeah, they're done with the hormonal therapy. They're
They're
not
done.
appropriate for hormonal therapy, so that's when I go for.
Either because I ran out of endocrine therapy,
Yeah.
because they're still having slow progression of their disease, but I ran through all lines of endocrine therapy and I don't have any additional endocrine therapies to offer them. Or if the patient is progressing rapidly and say, patients with liver disease, they concern me because you worry about a vital organ like the liver and you don't have too much room to try things. You can't wait 2, 3 months if you have a big liver met. Because if you have any liver dysfunction, you may end up, losing the battle. So in those particular patients, when I feel that it's time to move to systemic therapy, chemotherapy or ADCs, this is when I make the switch. But as long as I'm comfortable using endocrine therapy in those patients, I am using endocrine therapy. Now, having said that, I'm not saying that you cannot use endocrine therapy if you have liver metastases. Definitely, I do. It depends on the burden of the disease and how
Yes.
imminent is a liver shutdown, like a government shutdown,
Yeah. And how fast it grows. Yeah, I mean that's
Yes.
how fast this is progressing. Yeah. Well, that's very was very enlightening. I mean any final thoughts on the future of HR positive
I
metastatic breast cancer?
think it's very exciting times. I think we're looking for the combination that's going to give us in second line what we have in the first line now. The more effective treatment options that keep the patients independent with excellent quality of life and able to, navigate through their life with stage four disease and really live with it as a chronic disease, not as cancer, would be the goal. So I really thank you for the invitation. This was a great session and I appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time and for your knowledge. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'll see you soon, Wasim.
You.